And we have Kathy Scott with us, who wrote the book, of course, Death in the Desert, The Ted Binion Homicide. And I hear you're going to do a revised edition of that, Kathy.
Yes, I am. I'm planning on doing a second edition. I've already talked to my publisher about it. That is the plan. I'll have a lot of it done, and now I'm doing an addendum after the trial. And then make some changes in the book itself and come out as quickly as we can.
Yeah, you have any idea? Probably take a month or two, I guess.
Yeah, probably. It'll be the first book will be available still while the second one is printing. So that's the plan.
Well, I would like to recommend the book to people to go ahead and order it now because...
it's got a lot in it.
Yes, it does. And then they can get the new revised version. In fact, if they go to your website, KathyScott.com, can they still get an autographed copy?
Yes, absolutely. They can get autographed copies by going there. It's Kathy with the C, of course. Or they can order it through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com as well. Not autographed, but... Or they can go to their bookstore and ask the local bookstore to order it for them.
And of course, it's been a good seller all along, but right now you have a unique perspective since you did all the work on the first book and you've been following this trial, and I'm going to get into what you thought about the prosecution case. Of course, they get to come back again, right, with a rebuttal, and I think then the defense will get to do a surrebuttal.
Right. Yeah.
So what have we got? About 4 more weeks, probably, you think?
No, it's winding down pretty quickly. The defense has already started its case half day on Friday, and they had a handful of witnesses already, 3 or 4, and starting Monday morning, they're presenting their case again. They expect to be done in about a week or so, and I think it's going a lot faster than anybody expected. We're already 4 weeks into it, we're going into the fifth week, and the first trial, of course, only took it was 30 days. So we're already over what the first trial was, but with closing, this thing could be over in 2 weeks.
So you think the defense will have a couple of weeks of witnesses, and it'll probably be
about
it?
Week and a half, 2 weeks. I mean, that's basically what they said. It depends on if they decide to recall anybody, and then I think the prosecution has a chance, don't they? I mean, they've rested, but they
get to come back with a rebuttal.
Right, and so I think that they'll probably do that, and it's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, it's going quicker than we thought. I mean, that's what the attorney said in court to the judge, that they expected to be done in about 2 weeks.
Let's talk a little bit about the prosecution case in a moment, but as you said, the defense started Friday. They had an expert witness on, a toxicologist from Texas, who testified, regardless of what the prosecution kept trying to say, get him to say. He never really, I thought, got off the dime. He said that there was enough lethal drugs in the system to kill Ted Binion.
Actually, enough lethal heroin and enough lethal Xanax by themselves, and then of course combined Valium, Xanax, and heroin together was enough to kill him. Enough to kill an elephant, I think. But it's he went into much greater detail and seemed to really know what he was talking about than Bodden did. Bodden spoke about it in a very textbook fashion when he was on the stand.
You're talking about Michael Bodden.
Michael Bodden, Dr. Bodden, and I think he's a prosecution medical.
Now he's the one that came up with the murking theory, suffocation thing.
Right. Yeah, I think that they didn't think, that they didn't think the drugs would go, well enough, to prove it, so they threw in suffocation, which came out, long after Ted was dead.
Yeah, basically he ended up with two different, I called it the dueling Quincy's. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, Bodden never really saw the autopsy, the body itself.
No, Dr. Bodden never saw the body, but I think what was interesting was that Dr. Bodden is not a toxicologist, he is a pathologist. He sees the body when someone dies, but a toxicologist is the one who determines from the blood tests and all of that, you know, and from blood, from tissue, from the body, from the lungs and everything else, the stomach, what the person, you know, if drugs were involved, you know, were they enough to kill the person? Not Bodden's expertise, although that's what he testified to, which the, you know, defense, you know, protested, but of course, Bodden's testimony was allowed to be in. He's been around, Dr. Bodden has been, for so long, testifying at $3,500 a day at trials that I think everybody looks at him as an expert on everything, and he really is not.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. They keep bringing out the money situation here, and we can talk about that a little bit. I don't know if the prosecution, you know, of all the prosecution witnesses, everybody there seemed to have a financial interest in the case. In other words, that they either got some reward money or they were part of the estate.
Right.
Or
everybody's got a connection, and it all boils down to money, unfortunately. You know, so it you know, and we'll see if the jurors look at that as making them, you know, not credible witnesses. You know, we'll all find out in the end.
Now, the other thing on the defense, it kind of had the prosecution tried to mix everybody up with these cell phone records, and I guess that was kind of a strange deal. The guy was there talking to Rick Tavish and Sandy Murphy, and yet the prosecution insisted on introducing these phone records, and it was even backed up there with a time stamp on the bill. So I mean,
right, but the time stamp didn't say what number was called. But I think that what was confusing was that Rick had a couple of different cell phones, and at one point Sandy Murphy was using one of his cell phones. So it's hard to say when it, which phone was called and which phone was used. I was confused watching it, and I think the witness too, when he's looking at phone records from somebody else, they're not his phone records.
Right.
A phone call he supposedly made 6 years ago or 5 years ago, whatever it was, he didn't, he got confused, and I don't know why the prosecutor wasn't confused. And then the witness said, then the witness was Bill Knudsen, an attorney who had talked with Sandy and Rick. And he said that, Rick's phone bill or whoever's phone bill it was didn't show the number called. So that didn't really prove a lot. Well, that means that Rick was making phone calls before and during lunch, but it didn't say who the telephone calls were to. So I think that was confusing. And then they brought up the phone calls of the attorney and what numbers he called during or right before lunch. And that testimony didn't make sense to me because he said that the attorney had called Rick right before they met, 10 minutes before they met for lunch. And, okay, you know, maybe he's saying I'm on my way.
That could certainly be the case.
That didn't make sense at all.
To me, it just seemed to me like it was perhaps going to get the jury to discount the whole thing because it was very confusing, and obviously, as you say, nobody knows who was talking on whose cell phone, and there weren't all the numbers weren't complete.
Right, and the attorney said that he was late by like 15 to 30 minutes for lunch, and that, you know, and who knows if he called. I mean, it'd be a common thing. I do that. If I'm running late, I take my cell phone and I'll call the person who said, hey, I'm on my way, I'm late. You know, and that may very well be what he did. He doesn't remember because it's been so long ago. But I don't think that pushed anything home. So it's interesting, the stuff that's coming out.
Well, what do you think of the prosecution's case so far compared to the first time? You were there the first time.
Well, yeah, the first time I think they just took the whole kitchen sink and threw it out to see what would stick on the wall. And this time some of the evidence, you know, from the first trial wasn't allowed in, some witnesses, that sort of thing. It's a different case. Also the delivery by the two prosecutors is different than the first. I mean, I can remember the two prosecutors in the first trial literally glaring, especially one of them, glaring with almost, you know, venom in his eyes at both Sandy and Rick, but especially Sandy. But I guess if you're a prosecutor, you have to feel, you know, you need it. You need to feel hatred toward the person you're prosecuting. I don't know. But I don't know if he was posturing for the jury, but that's not going on right now. You don't see them glaring, you know, shooting daggers at the defendant. So it's interesting. I don't know.
Was the person glaring, the present DA?
I'm sorry?
Was the person glaring in the first trial, the present DA?
Yes.
Okay, I figured as much.
Oh, I mean, it was palpable. I mean, it was every day.
Yeah, Kathy, it was the battle of the mayors, too. Mayor Oscar Goodman, the present mayor and a good lawyer in his own right, made a lot of reputation defending famous crime figures. And a very popular Las Vegas mayor, as a matter of fact. He was supposed to appear, but all he did was end up standing behind Sandy, who at one time was his client, and the judge read a statement from him. I thought that was kind of interesting. I guess the prosecution agreed to that simply because, after all, they have to work with this guy from now on, and Goodman probably didn't want to be too much of a high-profile trial, but at the same time, I think he believes in the innocence of his former client. So it was kind of interesting. Then the other mayor, Jan Jones, she testified earlier for the prosecution that she saw Ted Binion and just before he died, and he was in a good mood. And in fact, he was in such a good mood, he gave her $40,000 in cash.
$100 bills and that sort of thing. But I don't think the jury understood what they were trying to do. And Jan just basically confirmed. And then also Jan said, when this is noteworthy, that Jan said that he was up and happy and seemed healthy. And it was interesting because the medical expert for the defense said on Friday that that's often the case. When they're not using, there's a window, or when they're using, there's a window of several hours where they look great, feel great, and then when they come down is when they throw up and all that horrible stuff that their friends don't see behind closed doors.
No, there's a period, 2 to 4 hours, where you're very happy. Then you get into an hour or two of depression, then you really get sick.
Right, because that's one of the things that the prosecution has really been driving home, that, you know, this was a man who was happy and up, and everybody said he felt great, and that's what the guy says, when they're using, that's how they act. They're happy that it's the only way they can maintain by using.
Let's get back to this question of this prosecution and the last prosecution. Could you compare the two at all? I mean, I know the defense is much more detailed this time, probably.
Well, there a lot of the things that came out last time are coming out, and they're not doing the. They're being more careful. I think they're not slipping up. I think they each. There was something that happened. I can't remember what it was. But something came out that the defense didn't like from a witness, and then something that came out from the prosecution side that the defense didn't like. But they're being more considerate. They're not cold cocking each other. You know, they're not coming out with these huge.
I think the term is sandbagging.
Yeah, they're not sandbagging. They're not cold cocking.
It is a battle, and sometimes you get the impression that sometimes it does get personal. Not as necessarily this time as much as the last time, as you mentioned.
Yeah, no, it's not nearly as much, and I think that the protests and the objections are happening. One thing, too, I've noticed that, do you remember all the hearsay things that the relaying of things that Sandy supposedly told somebody and then Rick supposedly told somebody and the witness is getting up for the prosecution and repeating those alleged words. Whereas I've noticed with the defense now, when they put their witnesses on Friday, that those hearsay statements, boy, the prosecution just jumps up and protests and says, that's hearsay, you can't use it. And at one point, Tony Serra, Tavish's attorney, said, well, they can do it, but I can't. You know, that he allowed hearsay in for the prosecution.
Yes, uh-huh.
But not. Did you notice that?
Yes.
Yeah, that I thought was interesting, that Bonaventure is sustaining every single protest of hearsay, whereas they overruled the protest of hearsay by the defense, as the judge did. I noticed that right off the bat.
Well, Bonaventure was very pro-prosecution the first time around.
Oh, yeah.
And he still is,
oh,
but
sure.
But he's being a little more careful about it.
Yeah, he's not.
And when I say he still is, that's my opinion.
Right, and he doesn't have, he occasionally has that restlessness when the defense is up. He did that a lot. He doesn't yell at the attorneys, although he did yell at Cristalli once in court in front of the jury, but he's not yelling like he did before. I mean, it was obvious to the jury before, I think, who he favored. But he's also not treating the jury like, you know, they're his children and he's got to protect them, which is what he did the first time, and the jury really took to him. And they could tell who he was in favor of. And I think that's different. Well, you know, they gave him a thank you card, and he read it to the jury on the day of the sentencing was done, which seemed terribly inappropriate.
Yeah, we've talked about that. This time the jury missed lunch. because the judge wanted to go
on Friday because they didn't leave till 1:30,
right?
And their last break was like at 10:45. That is a long time.
You could see the tension building there, and I'm not talking about between the defense and the prosecution.
So you're going to be in town, huh?
Yes, I'll be in there, and I'll be by the courtroom. I want to check it out. I'll see you. Have a nice little visit. And
that's
great. Have fun, and we'll do our next wrap-up face-to-face.
Right, that's perfect.
Anything, I'm going to let you go in just a second, but I'm just kind of curious about how you feel. Do you think it's going to, you know, we can't tell because the defense really hasn't put the case on yet, but you've got a pretty good feel for the court in this case. I mean, how do you feel?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the prosecution? Do they have a winner? I mean,
it doesn't
seem like it to me. I mean,
they have a hurdle
to go, and that's reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen much that would call for murder.
No, I don't. There's no smoking gun. There's no evidence tying, you know, Rick to the house. There's no evidence tying Sandy to forcing him or burking him. I mean, that you know, burking is just, you know, so outrageous, it's unbelievable. But there's, I don't see a smoking gun, and I don't think the, I could be wrong, but, you know, in the eyes of the jury, I don't think the prosecution has proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. I just don't see it. I mean, when you look at the Scott Peterson case and the circumstantial evidence in that case, no forensics, you know, blood or anything tying him, they have a hell of a lot more evidence against Peterson than there is in this case. And yet the Peterson case, many say, is iffy, you know, because there are watchers who say it can go either way. In this case, I don't even think I think right now they have not proved their burden. I think they've done it.
One thing I wanted to mention before we leave, and that's actually it's two things, and that's the system and how it works. These private detectives pretty well took over this investigation.
One private eye, yeah.
Right. And
he had a financial
interest.
Tie as well.
Right. And pretty well they were just given, you know, carte blanche to do whatever they want to do. And the other thing is, I've never really heard bail bondsmen testify against people before. When you're a defendant, yeah. and you go down there to get a bond, if they have the right to call up a bail bondsman and say, well, what do they say? Everybody in the country be guilty, because right there you're under tremendous duress.
Right.
And you don't want people to be talking. You don't want anything to be talking.
And who knows what people are saying. They just get out of there as quickly as they can, I think, and who knows if they remember what is said.
I'm even surprised that is allowed, but evidently in Nevada, anything goes.
Yeah, it's just like living in a foreign country sometimes. You know, life is different in Las Vegas, but I don't think they've proved it at this point, and I think that the defense is going to bring in a lot more witnesses that to counter, you know, a lot of things that bring in doubt, tremendous doubt.
And here again, the jury does know that both Tavish and Murphy have spent time in jail. So they'd probably be more inclined, I would think. And see, that's a two-way sword, too. One way, well, they're in jail, I got to go back. But the other part is, well, you know, hell, they've already, you know, paid some of their penalty here, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, it's hard to say what they're, it's hard to say what they're going to do. The jury is...
Now, I do think that in today's society, juries are more inclined to throw the book at everybody.
Are they?
I think. That's just my opinion. I think everybody's guilty of everything. I don't think we're a kinder, gentler nation.
No, we're not. It's a middle-aged, it's kind of a middle-aged jury. I think somebody wrote that it was an older jury, but I don't consider older middle-aged. But, I mean, there's a guy who looks like he's in his late 20s, maybe early 30s. There's another guy in his 40s, a woman in her 40s, a woman in her 60s. A man, 60, another one maybe approaching 70, but it's the jury is not, it's mostly 30, 40, 50, 60, you know, and that's not, I mean, that's pretty across the board.
Well, I'd sort of say that they've got small juries these days.
Yeah, and I watch them. I mean, they laugh, they smile at things that the prosecution says, they smile at things the defense says. They watch Sarah like crazy. You know, they don't take their eyes off of him. He sneezed, and he sits right behind Sandy.
Yeah, I've noticed him sitting there.
Yeah, he sneezed, and I mean, a great big sneeze. And Sandy had a box of Kleenex right next to her, and she took the box without a lick, I mean, she just real fast, without even thinking, grabbed it and handed it to him. And I noticed that the jury watched her do that. And he smiled at her, said thanks, took the Kleenex, and she put it down. And I think it's interesting to watch the jury, because they don't miss much. You know, and Rick, whenever a witness has to identify him, Rick always nods at the person. Sometimes he grins. If he knows the person, they smile back at him. So I think that stuff didn't go on last time as much. So I think you're seeing more of a human side to both Sandy and Rick that you didn't see last time.
Despite the prosecution's efforts, best efforts, really, to paint them in the corner as being... self-centered, vicious, et cetera, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It just seems to me that this ambiance thing, if they do win a conviction, it'll have to be in that area, because they don't seem to have the evidence.
No, they don't have the evidence, and there's a lot. There are a lot of things that were allowed in, and I think usually it's my dog's bark.
That's my dog.
There are a lot of things allowed in testimony-wise that clearly are appellate issues. You know, Sarah just, you know, objects, or Chris Dolly, Sandy's attorney, objects, and those things come up if they're convicted. That'll go to the Supreme Court again. So I don't think they're worried. The defense, you know, they're working very hard. as are the prosecutors. So I think both feel good right now, but it's hard to say. You know, it's all up to the jury.
Yeah, you never know. And many people have misread juries both ways.
Yeah.
And
we should have a verdict next week sometime, no, on the Scott Peterson case?
I would think so. They've been going for 3 days now, and they had a weekend off.
Yeah.
It's interesting, talking about the Scott Peterson case, that Garagus didn't really put on a very long defense. And some defense attorneys do that anyway, you know, because they want to try to give the message that prosecution didn't have a case. Jerry Spence is famous for that.
Yeah, Jerry Spence actually is a very good friend of Tony Sarah,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. But yeah, I think with when Scott Peterson's attorney, his medical experts sort of fell apart on the stand, he just sort of, you know, cut his losses and rested. I think surprised everybody, but you know, it may have been a good place to quit. Because he didn't want to dig a deeper hole.
Well, it may have been. It'd be interesting. And I'm looking forward to the new revised version of your book.
Thank you.
When this comes out. And I'll see you in Las Vegas in person later in the week.
Great. Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.